Jodcast, flying through space debris to get straight to your radio with Naomi Asabra Frimpong, Claire Bretherton, Ian Harrison, Fiona Healy, Minnie Mao, Ian Morrison, and Francesca Pierce. The Jodcast, December 2016 edition. Hello and welcome to the Jodcast. I'm Fiona and joining me in the studio today are Francesca and Naomi. Say hi guys.
Hi.
Hello.
You've heard Naomi in the Jodcast before, but Francesca is new to us today, so this is her first Jodcast recording. So, Francesca, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, I'm Francesca. I've just started my PhD at the University of Manchester. I'm working on simulations of galaxy clusters and trying to get some cosmology out of that. So we'll see how that goes.
Cool, nice. Who's your supervisor?
I'm working with Dr. Scott Kay.
Oh, lovely. Welcome to the Jodcast. Tremendous fun. So in the show this time, I've got Minnie Mao interviewing Professor Ray Norris about EMU, and Ian Morrison and Claire Bretherton are taking a look at what's happening in the December night sky. But first, before all of that, here's Ian with this month's news.
In the news this month, shimmering radio bursts, the roundest object in the universe, and life in dino-killing craters. Another first was revealed this month in the fast-growing field of fast radio bursts. These FRBs have featured quite a few times in the Jodcast since they were first discovered in 2007. The incredibly bright pulses of radio wavelength light last for a fraction of a second and are highly dispersed, meaning the time the light arrives depends heavily on the frequency of the radio waves. Such large dispersions mean that the FRBs are almost certainly from outside of our galaxy, which, when paired with their high brightness, means they must come from extremely energetic events. Since the first description, there have been 17 so far announced, although more are definitely lurking on various astronomers' hard drives. The newly announced 18th FRB, called 150807, after the date of its observation, is interesting for a few reasons, as detailed in a new paper by a team of scientists led by Vikram Ravi of Caltech in the USA and Brian Shannon of the CSIRO Institute in Australia. Firstly, it is the brightest yet seen, with a flux of 120 Jansky's, only a factor of 100 or so times fainter than the entire Milky Way at that same wavelength. Secondly, the FRB has the lowest amount of dispersion so far seen, 266 parsecs per cubic centimetre. This dispersion measure is still much larger than the 70 expected for a source within our galaxy in the direction of the FRB, but suggests that the FRB is the closest so far observed. Because the FRB was so bright, the astronomers were able to see it in two different pixels of the detector attached to the Parkes radio telescope in New South Wales, Australia. The two different pixels correspond to radio waves bouncing off slightly different parts of the telescope, which have different efficiencies. By knowing the shape of the telescope response and comparing the brightness of the FRB in the two different places, they were able to approximately reconstruct where on the sky the burst came from. Localizing FRBs on the sky is somewhat of a holy grail for the new class of object. If we know where they are, it is possible to look for events which are at different wavelengths of light, but coincide in either position or time, meaning we could learn which star or galaxy the FRB came from, and hence how far away it is, or whether the bursts are associated with other short-lived but violent events, such as gamma-ray bursts. The astronomers showed FRB 150807 probably came from a region on the sky with an area of about 9 square arcseconds, about the size of Mars on the sky. This might seem like a small area, but the sky is a crowded place, and there are at least 3 stars and 6 galaxies we know of in the area that the burst could have come from. Even if we do not know exactly where FRB 150807 came from, it does have the ability to teach us about the region of space it travelled through to get here. By looking at how the brightness of the FRB changed as a function of wavelength, the team were able to see a phenomenon known as scintillation. As the light from the FRB travels to us, it passes through the intergalactic medium, or IGM. This IGM consists of a highly dilute plasma of free electrons and negatively charged ions. Exactly how much of it there is floating about in space is a very interesting question. Because the IGM gives off so little light, it is very hard to observe, something which FRB scintillation can be very helpful with. At the moment, each FRB is still special, that as we see more and more of them, they will become valuable tools for astronomy and possibly even cosmology. And rather than talking about individual ones on the Dodcast, we will be able to tell you how they teach us about the universe. Also in the news this month were observations of the roundest object ever seen in nature. The object is a star known as KIC 1114523, but I'm going to call it KIC as I refrain from calling the FLBs Furbies. Astronomer Laurent Guizon of the Max Planck Institute for Sonnensystemforschung in Göttingen, Germany, led a team who used the Kepler satellite to observe tiny fluctuations in the star's brightness. Kepler is usually used to spot exoplanets by looking for these changes in brightness as the planet passes between us and the distant star, but the sensitivity can also be used for other means. KIC belongs to a class of stars known as hybrid pulsators, whose brightness subtly pulses due to wobbles in the material making up the star. Monitoring these changes in brightness over long periods of time, astronomers can spot the oscillatory patterns as different density waves propagate through the star, just as earthquakes do on Earth, an analogy which gives the field its name of astroseismology. By looking at nearly 4 years worth of Kepler data, the astronomers were able to see how the different waves propagated in the star, which, amongst other things, depends on how round it is. KIC was found to be almost perfectly spherical, to 1 part in 1 million, with a difference of only 3 kilometers between its radius drawn from the center to the poles and the radius between the center and the equator. In a star which is more than 3 million kilometers across, which is about twice as wide as the Sun, this is not much. As well as setting new records, we can learn a few interesting things from this astroseismology about the composition, behavior, and environment of stars. Things rotating slowly tend to be rounder, as do things which have their shapes constrained by strong magnetic fields, with the team hoping to perform their analysis on many more stars in the future and use these observations to learn more about star formation processes. And finally, rocks recovered from deep within the Chicxulub crater were shown this month to have properties ideal for supporting microbial life. However, supporting microbes is scant compensation for dinosaurs and 70% of all species on Earth at the time, who were probably wiped out by the rock which impacted the Earth and created the 110-mile-wide, 12-mile-deep crater some 66 million years ago. The Chicxulub crater is unusual on Earth as it has an inner ring of rock peaks as well as an outer one. Such inner peak rings are observed on other solar system bodies, appearing more common as the size of the crater grows, but it is difficult to investigate the mechanisms by which they form without having access to the rocks themselves. A group of geologists have recently been able to drill down into the Chicxulub crater for the first time, recovering from under 1.3 kilometers of sea and rock a set of cylindrical cores. Analyzing these cores showed evidence that the inner peak rings are formed from rocks dredged up from deep below the surface by the impact, and were also far less dense and more porous than expected. Such porous rocks are excellent at hosting microbial life, and the scientists suggest that they may have provided an excellent shelter for life during the early periods of its blossoming on Earth, when our planet was subject to regular large impacts which would otherwise have created a very harsh environment.
Thanks for that, Ian.
Now Mimi interviews Professor Rhys Norris about IMU.
Hi everyone, my name's Minnie and I'm very excited that I get to interview my PhD supervisor, Professor Ray Norris. So, hi Ray.
Hi.
Did you want to just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, I got my PhD here in Manchester at Jodrell Bank many years ago, probably Bronze Age, well I'm told maybe it's the Jurassic. But anyway,
were there really dinosaurs when you did your PhD, Ray?
And so I was a postdoc here for a while, and then I moved to Australia, and I was involved in building the Australia Telescope Compact Array. It's been a fantastic workhorse over the last 20 years or so.
The best telescope in the world, really.
it's got some contenders like Merlin, actually. E-Merlin. And right now, the thing that really excites me, I think probably the most exciting thing I've done in my entire career is coming out towards the end of my career, and that's the Australian SK Pathfinder Telescope, which is a brand new telescope that we're building in Western Australia.
How much are they paying you, Ray? I see you're also wearing an ASCAP t-shirt.
Yes, I'll hold my shirt next to the mic so you can see it. It really is very exciting. I mean, in the entire history of radio astronomy, with all the radio telescopes in the world, we've just discovered about 2.5 million radio sources, right? That's all our knowledge of the radio sky is about 2.5 million radio sources. With my project EMU on the ASCAP telescope, we're going to increase that to 70 million. So in one experiment, I say one experiment, it takes a couple of years, but with this one project, we're increasing our knowledge of the radio sky by a factor of about 30. You know, so that is actually pretty cool. You know, I don't know what we're going to discover. You know, we know we're going to discover all sorts of new things. It always happens. As soon as you observe the sky in a new way, you know you discover new things. You know, is it going to be pulsars, quasars, dark energy? Well, no, it's none of those things. We already know about those. But there'll be, we know almost something, there's going to be something else that we discover and we can't guess what it is.
Ray Norris, the explorer of the unknown.
Yeah.
So can you back up a second for us, Ray? Tell us where you work. You said you're in Australia.
Yeah, so I moved to Australia and I joined CSIRO, which is the...
Note to our listeners, Ray has made a point of not telling us when he moved to Australia.
Yeah, I'm not
there may have still been dinosaurs back then.
That's right. So CSIRO is the government research organisation.
Right, CSIRO.
There's not an exact UK equivalent, really.
Okay.
And then just recently, earlier this year, I left half-time. I've moved to a university in Western
Sydney.
If
I understand correctly, you attempted to retire but failed.
I'm not very good at this stuff. So I ended up working half-time at CSIRO and half-time at Western Sydney University.
Good job. So now you have twice as much work.
That's right. Yeah. so my work in both places is to get EMU going.
Right, EMU. Yeah. So that's what we were talking about before I interrupted you, and that's what you're giving your colloquium on today?
That's right, yeah. So EMU stands for Evolutionary Map of the Universe.
That's an excellent name.
It is, rather. And it gets named in several places. So EMU is an Aboriginal constellation, which maybe we'll talk about in a minute.
Oh, really?
So named after this main Aboriginal constellation, that's our logo, Evolutionary Map of the Universe. That's what we're doing, we're mapping the universe in a way that lets us see the evolution of radio sources.
So how many more, you said before, 30 million? 70 million radio sources, and right now we only know 2.5 million radio
sources.
That's
right, yep. Wow. Yep. So it's pretty exciting. And the idea is that, you know, we, in our puny human lifetimes, can only get a snapshot of the universe. We can't see things changing with time, we don't live long enough. So how can we figure out how the universe changes with time? And what we want to do in EMU is we take snapshots of these 70 million galaxies. It's a bit like DNA sequencing. You then try to figure out what order, because you've seen them in all these different stages of evolution, and you try to put them together in a sequence. It's actually going to be lots of different sequences, and try to see how galaxies evolved from the earliest stage of the Big Bang. That makes sense. From the Big Bang through to the present day.
So that sounds terribly exciting, but I feel a little like you're yanking my chain here, right?
Mm-hmm.
I did my PhD with you, and something I remember very clearly is with radio continuum observing, we can't get a distance measure. So how are you going to map the evolutionary sequence of these radio sources?
That's what people used to think in the olden days, like when you did your PhD so long ago.
Dang it.
But you're right. One of our challenges is, we're looking at all these different radio sources. We know they're different periods of time in the evolution of the universe. We need to know their redshift. In other words,
their
distance, and also how far back in time we're looking. So something 10 billion light years away, it's taken 10 billion years for the light or radio waves to reach us.
Right.
And so we're actually seeing it 10 billion years ago in time, so just 3.8 billion years after the Big Bang. So we really are looking back in time. And yes, you're right. The challenge is, how do we measure that redshift? So optical astronomers do it by measuring a spectrum,
right,
seeing how the light has shifted, and they can measure it. Much harder in the radio. And I think a few years ago we were saying, oh, it's really hard. Mate of mine, Jim Condon, made his famous statement, there's nothing so useless as a radio source. by which I mean, if you've just got this blob of radio emission, and that's it, it really doesn't tell you very much. So you really want to dig in.
It's why people call it blobology.
That's right. We don't do, well, we try not to do blobology. So For example, if you observe over a wider frequency range,
right,
you find there is information there. And we're developing techniques to measure radio redshifts of sources.
How? Using the spectral shape?
Yes, the SEDs.
So but radio SEDs tend to be very... It's a power law, isn't it?
You've got, I need to show you my plot. I can't do this on the radio. My talk, I'll show you. But yeah, if you've only got narrow bandwidth, you see... it's a well-known fact that you've joined the two points that you've measured that almost certainly fits a straight line, right?
Well, of course.
Okay. Even with 3 points, maybe. But if you go right out in frequency, you look at the low frequencies with telescopes like LOFAR and the MWA, then you see the spectrum turning over.
Right.
If you go to high frequencies, like 20 gigahertz, then you see the spectrum falling off. The electrons running out of energy. Now, actually, high frequency observations are really hard to do. But a fair fraction of the EMU sources we will be able to see with the low frequency telescopes. So we will see that characteristic turnover. And that gives us some idea of the redshift. Now, we're not going to measure it to four decimal places like the optical people do.
Okay.
But we actually don't need to do that. For what we want to do, what we really want to do, is take the radio sources and put them into bins. We don't need to know exactly how far away the source is or exactly how old it is. What we want to know is this source in the last 5 billion light years? Is it in the next 5 billion or 5 billion after that? So for cosmology, we have many science scholars. One of them is cosmology. And we found that if we can take all our radio sources and measure cross-correlation functions. I'm not technical way of saying cross-correlation functions, but we measure the structure of the shape of the distribution of the radio sources.
So you're getting a low-resolution age of the source.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that how you measure your age, Raymond?
I have low resolution.
10 plus or minus an order of magnitude.
I've run out of decimal places. that's right. So if we can put all our radio sources into a few bins, for example, it turns out the cosmological tests we can do with EMU turn out to be really powerful. It depends on getting just a rough redshift, but doing
so
it
like,
well.
Is that what they call statistical redshift?
Yeah, that's right.
That's fantastic. That's so exciting.
Yeah, and so we'll be able to measure with EMU if all that works out. And of course, always in science there's question marks. You don't really know whether things are going to work out, I think. But if it all works out, we hope to be able to detect, for example, yes, we'll see dark energy and things like
everything
else.
Really? Dark energy?
Yeah.
We should come back to that.
Right. And but more interestingly, not that dark energy is not interesting, it's just that's not actually the thing that EMU is best at. What EMU is going to be best at is measuring two things. Firstly, deviations from general relativity. So does our knowledge of gravity, does it really work over large scales?
Right.
And you might say, well, that, yeah, sure, that's fine, that's dotting I's, crossing T's. No, it's much more than that. What could some, for example, brain world models from string theory predict that our universe is a brain, like a membrane,
right,
and there are other universes, and that gravity leaks between these brains. And if that's right, then over large distances, you should see deviations of gravity from the inverse square law that we measure on smaller distances. And EMU, we can actually detect that.
Really?
So we're
how?
It's buried in doing statistical things. I'll give you an example. So there's several techniques we use. One of them, if I've got a low redshift galaxy, a thing like the Andromeda Nebula, something really
Andromeda
nearby.
Galaxy,
Andromeda
I think.
And we're looking at the EMU sources, which are a long way away at high redshift on the whole, behind it. And the gravitational field from Andromeda does two things, because you get gravitational lensing.
Right.
So it does two things to the background sources. Firstly, it makes them a bit brighter.
Right. So
if we're measuring
that emission.
Yep. How many sources we see per square degree, we'll see an increase between nearby galaxies. But it also pushes them further apart. So we get fewer sources per square degree. And the gravitational lensing distorts space pushes them apart. And so you've got these two effects working in opposite directions. And it's like subtracting two very large numbers.
Right.
And the difference is very sensitive to what goes into those numbers, and that depends on general relativity. Now actually, Andromeda is really local. Andromeda would be useless, it's too close. But you go to a galaxy a bit further away,
right,
but nearby, relatively nearby, within a billion light years or so. A few billion light years, and they really have a big effect on the galaxies behind that we detect the EMU. So all we need to do for this test, we just need to take our EMU sources and put them in two bins. We don't want the nearby ones, we'll just throw those away. So we say, okay, let's forget all our EMU sources. Anything below, let's say, a redshift of 1, we discard. Anything above a redshift of 1, we keep.
Right.
And then we go to an optical survey like Sloan or SkyMapper or Titan, and take the nearby, they're our nearby sample, and we note. Don't actually actually have to look at how these background sources move. You actually do a cross-correlation between the near-ground and the foreground.
Okay.
And our simulations that we've done on this effect show that we're actually going to be really sensitive to deviations from general relativity on large scales. That's
so why are the radio sources better than using the deep optical,
because
like EFDS field?
Yeah, we go much deeper than that. So optical surveys on the whole don't go very deep, except on very small areas.
Right, so like the Hubble deep fields or the ultra-deep fields.
Yes, exactly. Those really deep fields go very deep,
okay,
over very small areas. So,
but radio isn't limited, so you can see right out to the edge of the universe.
That's right. So the average galaxy in EMU will have a redshift of about 1.5.
Really?
Whereas that's an average galaxy, and that's already into the...
So that's well over half the age of the universe.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
That's really neat.
Another thing we can detect, same sort of technique, is the noise that is in inflation. So we know the universe started a big bang, and
right,
it suddenly blew up with inflation, and that at the end of inflation it wasn't perfectly flat, it had little bits of noise in, and that noise is actually what leads to the structure we see in the universe today. And the question is that noise just ordinary Gaussian noise, something you hear on the phone, you know, or is there some structure to it? So if for example, suppose in the early universe had cosmic strings, which is a type of singularity, that actually shows up in a pattern in the noise, and it turns out we're actually very sensitive to measuring that noise as well.
Really?
Again, doing these cross correlations and things like that, and that's called the non-Gaussianity test, and we think we're going to be able to have a really good stab at that as well.
That's fantastic. So the title of your colloquium, it was...
I don't remember.
I've got it written
down. It is something like WCF ...
The colloquium today is titled WTF ... Extracting the Science from EMU.
Right.
I was a little concerned. Right, it seemed a little bit risque to swear in the title of your colloquium.
WTF are three perfectly normal letters in the English language.
I must have misunderstood. Would you like to tell us a little bit more about WTF?
Yeah, so one of the interesting things in EMU, I said right at the beginning, that in EMU, like many science projects, of course, we've got a number of science goals. I just talked about a couple of measuring non-Gaussianity and so on. We're going to see how galaxies evolve and things. And we understand how to do that. And we think we're going to make important steps forward. And that's how a lot of astronomy is. It's incremental steps, valuable steps. But you also know that when you do a big survey like EMU, often you stumble across things you didn't expect to find at all. And history shows you get pulsars, quasars, dark energy, and so on. So what is the pulsars, quasars, dark energy that we find in EMU? Well, we don't know, obviously. How are we going to find them? That's interesting. So you look at something like how pulsars are discovered. So Jocelyn Bell was a student at Cambridge, and yeah, she's looking through her data, and she found these bits of scruff.
Little
so
green men, right?
Yeah. So but you look at the things that went together to make that great discovery. So and she discovered pulsars.
And didn't win the Nobel Prize.
Her supervisor got the Nobel Prize.
That does not sound
fair. The supervisor of several brilliant students. I think this is an excellent idea. When they make great discoveries, I should get the Nobel Prize. That seems fair to me. Anyway, so she was persistent, she was right, she knew her instruments, and she's very familiar with the data. Right? So can we do this with our scan? Well, with EMU? And I think the answer is no, actually. The trouble is, we have something like 70 petabytes a year of data coming off ASCAP.
That's a lot of MP3s.
So if we recorded the data from ASCAP onto Blu-ray discs,
right,
the pile of Blu-ray discs each day, we put them all in a pile, that pile of discs would be 62 kilometres high.
Wow.
From one day's observations. Right, so students aren't going to be going through the data, right?
Well, not if you're like your students.
Right. So how are the Jocelyn Bells of this world going to find the discoveries in the data? And it's hard. You just can't sift through the data. There's too much of it. What you can do with the data, we've got very good tools for asking very direct questions like how do we measure non-Gaussianity? And we do these statistical tests, you know. We know how to do that. What we don't know how to do is how do you discover the unexpected stuff? And that, I think, is one of the big challenges facing astronomy right now. Because do you know that if you look at what telescopes actually do, most of the big discoveries are actually unexpected. If you look at the discoveries from Hubble, so there's National Geographic a few years ago got a panel to rank the 10 top discoveries from Hubble. So,
right,
you know, they've got dark energy, stuff like that. And you rank these top 10 discoveries. Then you ask, how many of those discoveries were part of the justification for building Hubble and launching it?
Right.
Billions of dollars. How many did they plan to make? The answer's one.
Out of the 10?
Yeah, so 90% of the discoveries of Hubble were completely unplanned. So if you build a telescope and all you do is discover the things you were planning to discover, you've actually only got 10% of the potential discoveries of that telescope.
So WTF is an acronym.
Yeah. So what we do when we're looking for these discoveries, we're looking for outliers, things that aren't like the things we expect to see, statistical outliers. So WTF stands for Wide Field Outlier Finder. If you thought it stood for anything else, what did you think it stood for, by the way?
Nothing at all. I had no preconceptions. Oh,
right.
Boy.
Okay. Well, leave the list.
Wasn't I your PhD student when you came up with WTF? I remember sitting in your office shaking my head saying, Raymond, that is a terrible acronym.
Actually, it's one of my better acronyms, I think. It's funny, you think it doesn't, it's a bit of fun, right? And you think it doesn't actually matter. So Amazon Books, they're also one of the biggest providers of web services and cloud computing.
Right.
So Amazon Web Services, they kindly gave us a grant to develop the WTF project.
Right.
And they gave us a grant of disk space and CPU cycles and so on. And so, which is really nice of them, we've used it to good effect. What really amused me was there's some magazine had an article about our project, about
right.
WTF, and they got picked up by somebody in Amazon, and there's this lovely stream of tweets on Twitter of executives in Amazon saying, well, I'm involved in a project called WTF, you know, and just having a name like that, it catches people's attention, actually. So
I understand that. I study spiral dragons.
Right. So names are important.
What's in a name?
Yep.
That's really neat. So you said that WTF is one of your better acronyms. To be perfectly honest, I quite like EMU. But if I understand correctly, ASCAP, and just for the record, I think ASCAP is a very odd acronym. It sounds a little odd.
Right, okay. By the way, EMU wasn't entirely mine. It's also Jim Condon. I forget exact process, but I know that...
I think you sent out an email. This was like way back in 2010 or so. I was a PhD student.
Then,
and you sent out an email saying, well, we're going to be doing this amazing project. What are we going to call it? So what happened there? Do you want to just tell us that story?
You probably remember better than I do, I think.
I remember you sent out the email.
Yeah.
And I remember walking into your office and you being really excited that Jim had sent you email.
Yeah, but he had silly words for it, I think. He said, because he knew about my interest in Aboriginal astronomy.
Right.
And he said, why don't you give us an Aboriginal sort of thing, like EMU? A great idea, Jim. Obviously, that's what we should be doing. And I forget the words he suggested, but I didn't know that good. And I think I filled in the words.
Sorry, Jim.
He was the universe. Yeah, no, it's good. This is how collaboration
and
works.
If I understand correctly, almost all the ASCAP Pathfinder projects are named after Australian animals.
Well, a fair number of them are. So
did that all start out? I think it all started after EMU.
I think we probably started the ball rolling and then...
Yeah.
Don't ask me... So Wallaby is the other big project on ASCAP, but don't ask me what Wallaby stands for.
So Wallaby is the H1 project to EMU's continuum.
Yep, that's right. So EMU and Wallaby are the two key projects that are really driving ASCAP.
Right.
And they're sort of partner projects. We're doing the continuum and Wallaby are looking at the hydrogen galaxies.
Right.
And then there's a number of smaller projects. There's POSSUM, which is the polarization project.
Right.
The original suggestion for that was armpit. I just thought it was the worst acronym ever.
I think that's fantastic.
And I was part of that project. I'm not going to be part of a project called armpit.
Raymond, you're so superficial. What's in a name?
Well, a project by any other name may not get funded. Anyway, so Brian Gainsler was giving this talk about armpits.
I remember that. Everybody referred to Brian Gainsler's armpits.
That's right. And I sit in the front row. I have no idea what Brian Gainsler was talking about because I was working on acronyms. And so it got some questions at the end. And I said, what about possum instead of armpit?
Polarization, rotation measures.
Something sources. Yeah, I don't know.
Because armpit was, I think, ASCAP rotation measure, something.
Polarization. Right,
yeah. And I think there's also Dingo.
Dingo, yep. And that's looking for neutral hydrogen very far away in the universe. It's a very deep neutral hydrogen.
How does that compare with Wallaby?
Goes deeper than Wallaby in a smaller area.
Okay. Yep. Wallabies go deeper than... No, Dingoes go deeper than Wallaby.
Yep, that's right. Yep.
Got it.
And I'm probably missing some of this. I think the other projects don't have Australian animals.
Well, obviously nobody remembers them then. Actually, I was just...
And of course you have the Taipan spectroscopy survey as well.
Oh yeah, that's the complementary optical survey.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
So yeah, no, recently, as you know, Bjorn Emons put in a proposal that he titled Koalas, which makes me quite happy. So Aussie, Aussie, Aussie. Oh, we're taking over today. Right. So you had acronyms there, and I think you also had a whiskey-related acronym earlier on in your career. Are we not allowed to talk about that?
Sorry, that's not... We had a project called Lagavulin. Are we allowed to talk about commercial products? Anyway, it's called Lagavulin, and which is a very nice malt whiskey. And that was a joint Australian-US project to look at the links between starvation...
What did Lagavulin stand for?
I don't remember. low luminosity active galaxies using VLBI something something something. But then one of our team, Charlene Heisler, objected to it. She was teetotal and thought it was wrong, and we renamed it Cola.
Wow.
Compact objects and low power AGM.
That's a lot more. I suppose that's more age friendly.
Right.
How interesting. So the other thing I wanted to ask you was that you said with EMU you can measure the dark energy content of the universe. I mean, that's what, like 75% of the universe?
Yeah.
How? We know nothing. I know nothing about dark energy. I mean, just to briefly sum up what the known, the visible universe or the known universe, the mass that we see is like from 4%, and then dark matter is, I don't recall.
I forget the numbers offhand, but yeah, it's something like that. So what we're doing in EMU, we're looking at these galaxies with black holes in, right? So a lot of the science of EMU is understanding how the black hole interacts with the galaxy. But things like this, the cosmology, they're just using the galaxies as test particles. And these test particles are spread throughout the universe, going right back to the early days of the universe. And so we know that the universe, in the absence of any other forces, these things on average are going to be uniformly scattered throughout the universe. And so what we actually do is we use these to measure the shape of the universe. So any deviations from uniformity we know isn't going to be due, you know, to God putting more black holes over here than over here. We know that's going to be a distortion due to the universe. So we're using effects like that. So
you're assuming it's smooth and even to begin with. Is that a fair assumption?
That's right.
Okay.
Yep.
That's interesting.
And so, and going from there to the actual numbers, I'm afraid it's just maths. I described the cosmic magnification by nearby galaxies. That's the sort of thing. I'll give you another one if you like. There's a thing called the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, which is where you get a supercluster and photons from the Big Bang coming through the supercluster get accelerated and then decelerated as they come out again because of the gravity of the supercluster. And in a flat universe, that completely cancels. If you've got dark energy, then as the photon is going through the cluster, the cluster's expanding and accelerating, and that gives you a net increase in energy of the photon.
Wow.
And so to measure that, we cross-correlate the microwave background from Planck with our galaxies, and that tells us about the dark energy of the universe. And we can actually measure, in principle, we can measure how that changes with time over the life of the universe.
That's very neat. So I would like to go back to something else you said right at the beginning. You said that the EMU is an Aboriginal constellation. So if I understand correctly, you're one of the world experts on Australian Aboriginal astronomy.
I think the real world experts are the Aboriginal people themselves.
My bad. But did you want to tell us a little bit? Recently, I think on a previous podcast, we talked about Maori astronomy. So would you like to tell us a bit about Australian Aboriginal astronomy?
Yeah. So it's been really interesting. The last 10 years, I've been studying Aboriginal astronomy as a sort of sideline.
How did you get into that?
Really, I think I was curiosity-driven. When I lived in England, I was very interested in megaliths, Stonehenge and things, Bronze Age astronomy in Britain. And so I think the curiosity just carried over when I moved to Australia. I didn't realise how far it would take me. What I mean by that is that, 10 years ago, I started studying Aboriginal astronomy. People had written bits and pieces in the literature, and that was all good stuff. And I wondered, how deep did it go? You know, we knew there were Aboriginal stories about the sky. That's fine. That's good. Lovely stories. Did Aboriginal people really do astronomy in the sense of trying to understand the sky? Did they try to use the sky, the motion of the sun and moon, to predict eclipses or measure seasons?
So I suppose
that?
What you're doing here is you're defining what is astronomy in its most basic sense.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I thought, it'll take a year to answer that question. You know. 10 years later, I now realise you've hardly scratched the surface. And the answer is, firstly, that astronomy is incredibly important in Aboriginal cultures. And that's, I don't think anybody appreciates how widespread, how deep it goes in many Aboriginal cultures.
It's one of the oldest professions, right?
Right.
So, actually, I think when I was a summer student, or maybe just after I started my PhD, you took me on a bushwalk to Ku'ungi National Park, and you showed me all of those beautiful rock engravings that were very old, or we weren't sure how they were dated, or...
Not sure how old they are. So, yeah, I mean, one of those is the emu, in fact, which is, there's this beautiful engraving of an emu, which we think is a picture of the emu in the sky. I say we think, I mean, it actually lines up in the sky. With the
we'll try and get emu. A picture of that on our website.
Okay, so, that'd be really good, yeah. And we found that people explained eclipses, they explained how the tides work, had all these descriptions of how the world works. Based on their astronomy. They use it for navigation.
Can you give us an idea? So the Australian Aboriginals came to Australia 50,000 years
about,
ago.
Well, maybe more, but yeah.
Okay,
Wow. That's right. And we don't know when they started doing astronomy. It's interesting because they're almost untouched by other cultures. So we know it's 200 years ago when the British invaded Australia that they were doing astronomy, right? 200 years ago.
Right.
How far back does it go? We don't actually know. And that's one of our holy grails. How far back does it go? Certainly goes back a fair way. It's possible, if they've been doing it for a long time, their astronomy may well predate Stonehenge and so on.
Wow.
They may be the world's first astronomers, but we can't say that for sure.
And I know you've taken me to see some putative stone circles in Victoria.
Not putative.
They were,
some of us gets called Aboriginal Stonehenge, which isn't quite right because, well, first of all, it's not an imitation of something else. It's
right.
Its own thing. But it's a stone circle about 50 metres across, which is actually quite clearly aligned on the setting points of the sun at the solstices and the equinoxes. So
oh,
the guys who built this,
yeah.
The Watchung people, clearly knew about the position of the sun. Actually, there's an interesting local connection with Macclesfield, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the people who built that stone circle, the Watchung people... William Buckley was a convict from Macclesfield who escaped in Melbourne, I forget the date, it's like 10 or 20 years after the British arrived. And he spent 30 years living with the Watchung people.
Wow.
When he eventually turned himself in, so to speak, to the British again, he'd actually completely lost his English. He now spoke Watchung.
Really?
And,
wow.
And so he almost certainly... participated in ceremonies at the stone circle at Wurdi Youang.
Right.
And the bugger didn't write about it.
He
talks about lots of things. Yeah, he talks a bit about astronomy. He talks about their names, the Magellanic Clouds and things like this.
Wow.
But he doesn't mention Wurdi Youang.
He wasn't allowed to. Maybe there were...
Possibly, but he lived there 30 years. My guess is he would have been initiated.
Right, no, but maybe he wasn't allowed to tell non-initiated people.
Oh, that's... quite possible, yes, you could well be right.
So unfortunately, we've actually run out of time, which is a shame, because I'd love to hear more about Aboriginal astronomy. And I know you've written a book, I've got a signed copy at home, and we'll also link it, hopefully, to the website. And if you have any more questions for Ray, do write in, let us know, and we'll make sure to ask Ray anything you'd like to know about Aboriginal astronomy.
Yeah,
so thank you so very much for this, Ray.
It's my pleasure, it's great fun. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Minnie.
Now we come to the part of the show where we fit in all those other bits we can't fit in anywhere else, the odds and ends.
Okay, so I'm going to go first at my odd and end. My odd and end today is an article I found on space.com about a UFO. This is the headline that they used to get lots of people to click it. A UFO that crash landed in Myanmar. I mean, to say crash landed isn't even correct, it just crashed. In fact, it's not even a spaceship. It's kind of a bit of something. It looks a bit like a rocket or a jet engine. And in the picture you can see that it's kind of, it's like a long sort of cylinder thing that looks like it broke off some other thing. And the opening of the cylinder is probably about as tall as I am, which is about 5'4". I can tell that because I've got a dude standing next to it. But he looks taller than me, and he's sort of crouching down a little bit. Anyway, it crash-landed near a mine in Myanmar, kind of a remote mountainy area, so it's very fortunate that nobody was hurt. They don't really know what it is. Villagers said they woke up, they heard lots of loud banging and vibrations, and they were terrified. It's about 12 feet long and 5 feet in diameter. Oh, look, my estimation of height was almost bang on, actually. It did rip through a jade miner's tent, but since he wasn't in there at the time, so that was lucky.
That was very lucky.
And there was a smell of burning filling the air. That's according to local reports.
Was that the tent, or...?
I don't know. Or was it the UFO?
Yeah.
I mean, it looks a bit charred. I guess
falling through the atmosphere does that.
Yeah, it'll do that. Yeah. And... So at first they kind of thought maybe it came from an aircraft, and they figured it's some kind of engine, and they found some bits of copper wire and stuff in it. But It looks more like someone else has said, one former government official with the Department of Aviation has said that the image shown on Facebook, you can see he's doing a very detailed analysis there. He says from Facebook, he gathers, that it looks more like a rocket booster. But I'd have to agree with him. It kind of looks like it's very big and it looks too long to be a jet engine, but then what do I know? So yeah, and then they mention, apropos of nothing, that just yesterday China announced the successful launch of a Long March Rocket 11 into space along with 5 satellites. Which, what do they mean by that? I doubt it's one of those. Because if it's one of those, then you couldn't exactly call it successful. But I think what they're kind of going on to say is we're launching an awful lot of stuff into space. And sometimes it comes back down.
Or things fall off.
Or things fall off. Exactly. And that space debris is, you know, becoming a bit of a concern and a bit of a thing. Wait. The thing China was doing, it's meant to identify the locations of other things in space. So that'll be useful, considering space is getting full of bits of junk that fall down on the tents of unsuspecting jade miners. And then, so apparently then, the odds, this is important to know where these things are, because the odds of any one of us being hit by space debris are approximately 1 in 3,200.
That's huge.
Yeah.
How many are we on Earth?
There's 7 billion of us.
So like, watch out, people.
Yeah. Wear your helmet when you go outside.
It's a fashion statement as well.
Exactly. <Yeah. laughs> You can wear your tinfoil hat underneath. I feel nice and safe here in the Jodcast recording studio. We've kind of got lots of nice blankets and carpets and tables to hide under, lots of kind of soft furnishings.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll just camp out in here for the rest of time.
I'm a good Jordan.
Yeah, exactly. So that's it, regarding space junk. So now on to you, Naomi.
Okay, I'm talking today about the development in Africa with radio astronomy, which is codenamed DARA project. The SKA in Africa is a really big project for Africa. Africans are so eager to be part of it. And you know, South Africa has a lot of partners in Africa, like Ghana, Kenya,
right.
Madagascar, Mauritius,
okay.
Mozambique, Namibia, and Zambia. So the DARA project is training young scientists to take up the job opportunities that come out from the SKA project.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. So
oh, excellent. Actually, I don't know if this was SKA related, but I know some people from JBCA were in 2 African countries, and I forget which 2, to teach people radio astronomy.
Yeah, for the past 2 years, the DARA project is training African scientists. They have like a two-pronged approach. The first one is training them in their countries.
Yeah.
So like a very intensive 4 2-week program.
Uh-huh.
So they teach them astrophysics.
Yeah.
The technical side of astrophysics or radio astronomy, mm-hmm. and then observation and data reduction.
Right.
So they are taking basically undergraduate and master students.
Oh, that's wonderful.
With physics, mathematics, uh-huh. and uh-huh. engineering and computer science backgrounds.
Uh-huh.
And also have the advanced training, which I'm part of.
Okay.
So currently there are 6 of us in the UK, 1 PhD student in Oxford, and 3 master students in Hertfordshire University,
uh-huh.
1 PhD in Leeds, and I'm in the Manchester.
And in Manchester.
And
oh,
I'm Manchester. Right.
That's cool.
It's really great.
Yeah.
We are all being trained to go back and work on the various telescopes being converted in our countries currently. So it's really a very important project for Africa.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, and we are really eager to do.
You know, and wonderful for Africa and wonderful for radio astronomy, because if there were more radio telescopes in Africa, in that whole continent, like the possibilities for expanding baselines would be marvelous.
Marvelous for for both the whole SKA project.
Yeah, exactly.
In UK, the PI is Professor Melvin Hall.
Okay.
From University of Leeds, and uh-huh. in South Africa is Professor Ludwig.
Right. So is it, like, expected that you'll go and work out back in Africa after you've finished your training? Like, you're going and actually
work? Yeah, going back,
Okay, so they've sent you over here to learn some new tricks.
So we're all going back. So I'm going back to Ghana to work on the antenna that's being converted to radio telescope in Kuntusi. So all of us are really going back. Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, so it's a really great project.
Cool.
I think it's recommendable, and it shouldn't be only 2 or 3 years. It should continue in the future because we really need more
And are there plans to send more than the six of you?
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so, but currently there are only six of us. But I hope in the years to come they'll send more than six of us.
That would be amazing. Yeah. That's really cool. Wow, thanks for telling us about that. And to any of our Jodcast listeners anywhere in Africa, I hope you're listening.
Yeah, I really thank the project. It's a really brilliant idea. Yeah.
That's cool. Mm. Okay, on to you, Francesca.
So my odd and end this week was that they think they might have discovered a new supercluster out in the southern sky near the Vela constellation. No, it's known as the Vela supercluster because it's in the area of the Vela constellation in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
So for any southern hemisphere listeners, they might have seen it.
Yes. Well, so, probably not the supercluster because I'm guessing you can't.
No,
see
I meant the constellation. that is actually quite a good point because they haven't actually managed to see the supercluster because it's in the zone of avoidance. So basically, it's along the line of sight of the galactic plane, so we can't actually get any measurements from the centre of this potential supercluster because all of the galaxies and dust and stars in the way mask any observations that we try and do.
Okay.
So it was proposed in around 2008 that this cluster or extended mass region might be there in order to stop discrepancies between the peculiar velocity of our local group of galaxies, which they managing to get the correct discrepancies in the peculiar velocity of our local group of galaxies, because the current known supercluster near us is called the Shapley supercluster, which is approximately 650 million light years away. The gravitational influence of that is coming up with different peculiar velocities than we're actually finding.
Right, so they figured there had to be something else there.
Yeah, but obviously there has been no direct observations up until the last, year, because they've currently had a lot of telescopes pointed at it.
Okay.
At that area in order to try and get something.
Right.
And they found that this proposed supercluster is very extended. It's about 250 degrees by 20 degrees, so it actually extends beyond the galactic plane.
Right, okay.
So that's where we're getting most of our measurements from.
Okay, so they can actually observe, now that they know it's there.
They can observe the outer regions of it.
Sure.
And just in the outer regions, they found that there are potentially 20 new galaxy clusters, which is huge. That's a lot of galaxy clusters. That's a lot of physics and cosmology that we can get out of them.
Yeah, right, so what kind of science can they get out of that?
Well, it's basically to try and put constraints on cosmology, because galaxy clusters are thought we can get the ratios of baryons to dark matter and things like that. So basically, and this, from the preliminary calculations that they've done, the size of this supercluster, which is about 800 million light years away, they think it might have a similar mass to the Shapley supercluster.
Right. Okay.
So it does, they think, potentially account for the discrepancies in the bulk motion of our local group. And just as a side point, early next year they've got follow-up missions with the Taipan Observatory and also the South African SKA Pathfinder Meerkat, which are going to do observations on multi-wavelengths in order to try and get some even more physics out of this potential supercluster. And hopefully they will be able to say for definite that it is a supercluster.
Yes. Cool. Okay, well, that's really interesting. That's the best of luck to them, I suppose.
Yeah. Hopefully they're right.
Yeah, I hope they are right. Yeah, yeah. Anytime I hear something like this and they're like, oh, they think it accounts for such and such discrepancy, I'm like, oh, I hope it does. I hope they all get to have a little celebration when they ultimately prove that they're correct. Okay. Well, so now, taking us back from the southern hemisphere to the northern hemisphere, here's Ian Martin with this month's night sky in the northern hemisphere.
The night sky for December 2016. Well, we have some lovely long nights now, so there's lots to see. And in the evening, you can't help notice Venus dominating the western sky. And if you're up reasonably early in the morning, you can't help but see Jupiter becoming higher. And by the end of the month, it'll be basically due south after sunset, so it'll be easy to see. So what about the stars? Well, looking south after sunset, when it gets dark, there's not obvious to see. In fact, you have the square of Pegasus, the winged horse, upside down. Up to its left is the constellation Andromeda, which of course includes the Great Nebula in Andromeda M31. Above that is the W-shaped constellation of Cassiopeia. And one way to find Andromeda is to take the rightmost V, the right-hand side of the W, and use that as an arrow. And if you take some binoculars on a dark night and gradually work downwards, you should see a little fuzzy glow, which is the Andromeda galaxy. As the evening draws on, things become a bit more exciting. First of all, you'll see Taurus rising in the southeast with that lovely open cluster of the Pleiades highest in the sky. Below that to the left is the Hyades cluster with the bright star Aldebaran, not part of the cluster, but about halfway between ourselves and the Hyades cluster itself. And then as the evening draws on, Orion will appear over in the east. The lovely constellation, the three stars of Orion's belt, are pointers. They point upwards to the Hyades and the Pleiades, and down to the left to the brightest star we have in our northern constellations, Sirius. Over to the left and upper left of Orion, we have Castor and Pollux, the two brightest stars of the heavenly twins. And then working around a bit, fairly high up, there'll be a bright yellow star, which is Capella, which is in Auriga. The Milky Way passes through Auriga, and there are quite a number of open clusters that you can see, in fact, with binoculars on a clear, dark night. Well, what about the planets? Well, actually, I've been seeing Jupiter fairly high now in the southeast as I get up at about 6:30 to 7 in the morning. You can't really fail to see it. It's lying in Virgo. It rises at about 2:30 UT at the start of December, but about 1 o'clock UT by its end. During the month, its magnitude rises a little bit from minus 1.8 to minus 1.9 magnitudes. And at the same time, of course, the angular size is increasing from 31 to 35 arc seconds. By the end of December, it will reach the meridian, that's due south, by dawn, with an elevation of 35 degrees. Sadly, each year, that maximum elevation is getting less as Jupiter follows Saturn down towards the lower part of the ecliptic. So early risers should be able to observe the equatorial bands and up to four of the Galilean satellites as they weave their way around it. But what about Saturn? It passes behind the Sun on the 10th of December, so cannot be seen for much of the month. However, by about Christmas Day, it will rise about an hour before the Sun and may just be seen in the brightening dawn at a magnitude of plus 0.5. You may well need binoculars to spot Saturn lying to the southeast and to the left of Antares in Scorpius. But of course, please do not use binoculars after the Sun has risen. Now Mercury reaches its greatest elongation east, that's to the left of the Sun, on the 10th of December, and may be spotted low in the southwest for the first 2 weeks of the month. Its angular size is increasing from 5.5 arc seconds at the start of the month to 7 arc seconds by the 10th. At the same time, its gibbous phase falls from 68 to 56% illuminated. It reaches magnitude 0 on the 17th, but it's been moving back down towards the Sun, and so will be lost in the Sun's glare by about the 19th or so. As it moves to inferior conjunction, that's between the Sun and the Earth, on the 28th. Well, Mars has been around for a very long time. It will be seen low in the south after sunset. It dims from magnitude plus 0.6 to plus 0.9 during the month as it moves eastwards into Aquarius from Capricornus on the 16th. Its disk is now only about 6 arc seconds across, so you can't really expect to see any details on what I think is a salmon pink disk rather than red. Now Venus is becoming increasingly obvious, visible now in the southwest after sunset, setting about 3 hours after the Sun at the start of December, but increasing to about 4 hours after the Sun by month's end. It's moving rapidly eastwards from Sagittarius into Capricornus, that's on the 7th, and brightens from magnitude minus 4.2 to minus 4.4, whilst its angular diameter increases from 17 to 22 arc seconds. Now at the same time, the illuminated area of the disk falls from 68 to 56%. So the two things compensate, And that's why Venus's brightness stays pretty constant at around the 4.2 mark for almost all the time it's actually visible in the sky. Finally, what about some highlights? Well, on December the 3rd, should it be clear after sunset, you may be able to spot Venus below a thin crescent moon. Whenever there's a very thin crescent moon, and if the Earth is fairly cloudy, you have a chance of spotting what's called Earthshine, the old moon in the new moon's arms. And that's really rather nice thing to see. So Venus will be at magnitude minus 4.2. On December the 4th, after sunset, you can see Venus, Mars, and a crescent moon together, looking low in the south-southwest. Obviously, a day later, the crescent won't be quite so thin. Now, a nice one. On December the 13th, before dawn, the moon occults Aldebaran in the Hyades cluster. So during the night of the 12th, 13th of December, the full moon will pass through the Hyades cluster and actually occult many of its stars. And at around 6.15 UT, it will occult minus 0.7 magnitude Aldebaran, which, as I've said before, lies between us and the cluster. Now, it's right at the very edge of the lunar disk, so it could well be what's called a grazing occultation from parts of the UK, and may not even be occulted at all from some. Well, we have two meteor showers this month. December the 14th and 15th after midnight, we have the Geminids, or the Geminid meteor shower. And in fact, that's become probably one of the most reliable in recent years. It always used to be the Perseids in August, but now the Geminids tend to be better. And I saw an absolute wonderful display last year, in fact, on board ship in the ocean, not far from Brazil. Sadly, this is not a good year for the two nights when the peak of the Geminids occurs, simply because it's very close to full moon, and the fainter meteors will not be seen. However, as I saw last year, the Geminids can often produce what are near fireballs, perhaps not quite a fireball, but pretty damn bright. And in fact, it's therefore still worth observing. You'll certainly see those if they happen. Obviously, an observing location well away from towns or cities will pay dividends. The relatively slow-moving meteors arise from debris released from the asteroid 3200 Phaeton. This is unusual, as most meteor showers come from comets, and the radiant, which is where the meteors appear to come from, is close to the bright star Castor in the constellation of Gemini. And on the night sky page, put in night sky jodrell bank, there'll be a chart showing you where the radiant is. Obviously, if it's clear, it'll be cold, so wear a woolly hat, wrap up well, and perhaps have some hot drinks with you. December the 22nd and 23rd, in the late evenings, we have the Ursid meteor shower, and that implies the radiant lies in the constellation of Ursa Major. It's actually close to the star Kokab, in Ursa Minor. So look northwards at high elevation. Occasionally there can be a higher rate than the typical 10 to 15 meteors per hour, which isn't really all that much. But pleasingly, the moon will not affect our view until really the early hours of the early morning. So you have a chance at least of seeing some of them in the hours up to and beyond midnight. On December the 30th, the night of the 30th, 31st, after sunset, Venus closes on Mars. In fact, Venus has been catching Mars up in the sky, and it's closest this month, as you might expect, on the 31st. So have a look either on the 30th or the 31st, and you should see Mars in Aquarius to the upper right of Venus, both of them fairly low in the south-southwest. Finally, the Alpine Valley on the Moon. I do like observing and imaging the Moon. It's an easy thing to image because it's so bright. Those two nights, the 6th and the 20th, are good nights to observe what is called the Alpine Valley if you have a small telescope. It lies close to the limb on those two nights, and it's a little cleft within the Apennine mountain chain that marks the edge of Mare Imbrium. It's about 7 miles wide and 79 miles long. A thin rill actually runs through its length, which is really quite a challenge to observe, and I can't claim ever to have seen or photographed it. So over the next two nights, following the 6th As the Terminator moves round towards full, you can see the dark crater Plato and the young crater Copernicus in view. And also, around the top, just round to the left of Plato, a rather lovely region called Sinus Iridum. In fact, not Sinus Iridium, it's Sinus Iridum, the Bay of Rainbows. And when the Terminator crosses the bay, the mountains on the left-hand side are lit up. They look a little bit like the backbone of a dinosaur. So let's hope we have some nice nights to observe the heavens during December. And of course, Happy Christmas and New Year.
And thanks for that, Ian. And for our Antipodean listeners, here's Claire Bretherton with the night sky where you are.
Kia ora, and welcome to the December Jodcast from Space Place at Carter Observatory in Wellington, New Zealand. After a bit of a cold, wet, windy and somewhat shaky November, we're finally moving into our summer months as we head towards the Southern Hemisphere summer solstice on the 21st of December. Our eastern evening sky is now dominated by our summer constellations of Taurus, Orion and his two dogs Canis Major and Canis Minor. The summer Milky Way stretches through these constellations and along our southern horizon. Although not as bright as our winter Milky Way, we can still pick out the mottled glow of bright and dark regions when observed from a dark location. The bright regions are the combined light of the many distant stars that form our galaxy, whilst the dark patches are clouds of interstellar gas and dust that block the light from more distant stars. Throughout this region there are many star clusters and nebulae that can be observed with binoculars and small telescopes, and some that can even be seen with the naked eye. We'll take a look at some of the best examples in our Jodcast this month. We'll start our tour in Orion, sitting high in the east after dark. In Greek mythology, Orion is a hunter and the arch-enemy of our winter constellation, Scorpius. The two continually chase each other around the sky. As Orion rises in the east to dominate our summer skies, Scorpius sinks down below the western horizon. Orion lies along the celestial equator and can be seen at least partially throughout the world. As he was invented in the northern hemisphere, in New Zealand we see him upside down. Orion is easy to find by the three bright stars that form his belt. Here in Aotearoa we call these Tautoru, meaning line of three. Above Orion's belt is a line of faint stars which form Orion's sword in the northern hemisphere. For those of us in the southern hemisphere, we see the belt and sword instead as a pot or saucepan. At the top left of the constellation is the bright blue-white supergiant Rigel. Whilst Rigel has been given the designation Beta Orionis, it is in fact normally the brightest star in the constellation and the seventh brightest in the night sky. In contrast to the blue of Rigel, at the bottom right of Orion is the red supergiant Betelgeuse Alpha Orionis, the second brightest star in the constellation. Betelgeuse is a star that's coming towards the end of its life. As it runs out of fuel to burn, it has bloated out and cooled down, giving it its wonderful red hue. Estimates of the mass of Betelgeuse range from around 8 to 20 times that of the Sun. And if it were placed at the center of the solar system, its surface would reach out almost as far as the orbit of Jupiter. One day soon, Betelgeuse is going to end its life in a supernova. Of course, soon to astronomers could be a million years or more. But if it does go bang within our lifetimes, it's sure to be a spectacular sight, perhaps becoming so bright you could see it in the daytime. At a distance of over 600 light years, it is possible that this explosion has already happened, and we're just waiting for the light to reach us. Orion contains a number of interesting objects to observe with both the naked eye and binoculars or telescopes. If you look carefully, you may see the middle star of Orion's sword has a fuzzy appearance. This is the Great Nebula in Orion, or M42. The Orion Nebula is a stellar nursery, a huge cloud of gas and dust in which new stars are being born. At around 1,344 light-years away, M42 is the closest massive star formation region to the Earth, with around 700 stars in various stages of the star formation process. In the heart of the Orion Nebula is a small group of bright stars known as the Trapezium Cluster. The ultraviolet radiation from these stars is lighting up the surrounding gas. Whilst easily spotted with the naked eye, through binoculars or a small telescope, the nebula is a wonderful sight. Take your time and you should be able to clearly see some of the nebulosity of M42 and the bright star cluster that lights it up. Another nebula in Orion that is well worth a look is the reflection nebula M78, easily found as a hazy patch in a small telescope. With a larger telescope, the famous Horsehead Nebula, silhouetted against the emission nebula IC434, is a lovely sight, just to the south of the star Alnitak, the easternmost star in Orion's belt. Its proximity to bright Alnitak makes viewing the Horsehead Nebula more challenging, but long exposure photographs will reveal much more detail. Alnitak is actually a multiple star system. The ultraviolet radiation from this star is illuminating a cloud of dust and gas, creating NGC 2024, the Flame Nebula. M42, M78, IC434 and NGC 2024 are all part of the Orion Molecular Cloud Complex, a vast area of young stars, bright nebulae and dark clouds spreading all the way from Orion's belt to his sword and covering several degrees in the sky. Following Orion's belt to the left, we come to an upturned V-shape of stars marking the head of Taurus the Bull. At the bottom of this V is the bright orange star Aldebaran at around 65 light-years away, representing the Eye of the Bull. The other stars in the V are part of the more distant Hyades cluster. At 153 light-years away, the Hyades is the closest and one of the best-studied open clusters to Earth. It is estimated to be around 625 million years old. Over time, the cluster will continue to spread out and disperse into space, with some of the largest and brightest members already coming towards the ends of their lives. Near to the fainter of the two horns of Taurus, and just about visible in binoculars under excellent conditions, is the Crab Nebula. First discovered by English astronomer John Bevis in 1731, the Crab Nebula is a supernova remnant now believed to be associated with supernova SN1054, observed and recorded by Chinese astronomers in 1054 AD. Continuing further around the sky, you come to another famous open cluster, the Pleiades, or M45, at a distance of 444 light-years away. This group of stars is even younger than the Hyades and is dominated by a number of hot, massive blue stars, only around 100 million years old. The Pleiades has many different names in many different cultures, but here in New Zealand it is best known as Matariki, meaning little eyes or eyes of God. The rising of this group of stars for the first time before the sun, around June each year, marks the coming of the Maori New Year. Following Orion's belt to the right, you come to Sirius or Takarua, the brightest star in our nighttime sky, and in the constellation of Canis Major, Orion's large hunting dog. Canis Minor, the small dog, is a little below, close to the eastern horizon. Its brightest star, Procyon, is actually a binary star system, consisting of a white main sequence star and a faint white dwarf companion. At just 11.46 light-years away, it is one of the nearest neighbours to our sun. From here, you can follow the band of the Milky Way around the sky, through the False and Diamond crosses to Crux, the Southern Cross, low in the south. Sitting beside the Southern Cross is a dark patch called the Coalsack Nebula, a huge cloud of interstellar gas and dust about 600 light-years away. Known as a dark nebula, the gas and dust in this cloud are blocking the light from more distant stars, obscuring them from our view. To Maori, the Coalsack Nebula is known as Te Pātaki, or the Flounder. In our western skies, we see a trio of planets this month. Mercury is low on the southwestern horizon for the first half of the month, setting around an hour and a half after the sun, before sinking into the evening twilight after the 15th. Venus is higher in the west, the first thing you'll see as the sky begins to darken, and sets close to midnight. Mars is much fainter and to the top right of Venus, moving through Capricorn and into Aquarius over the course of the month. We also have a number of meteor showers happening this month. The Theonisids reach their peak on the 6th of December and are thought to be associated with the comet D1819W1 Blancpain. With the radiant in the constellation of Phoenix not far from Achenar, this shower is well placed for Southern Hemisphere observers throughout the hours of darkness. The Theonisids were first discovered during an outburst in 1956, where approximately 100 meteors an hour were seen from locations across the Southern Hemisphere. However, activity is very uncertain, and rates this year are likely to be much, much lower than this. The minor Papad Velid meteor shower also reaches its peak at around the same time, with a zenithal hourly rate of around 10. Just a few days later, peaking on the 15th of the month are the Geminids. This is one of the best meteor showers of the year, but we are not well placed for viewing in New Zealand, with the radiant in the constellation of Gemini and well north of the equator. The constellation is at its highest around 3 a.m, but still appears low in our northern sky. Due to this low height, we only see around half of the meteors visible to those in the northern hemisphere, but it's still well worth looking out for. Wishing you clear skies and a Merry Christmas from the team here at Spaceplace at Carter Observatory.
Thanks for that, Claire. And now on to the feedback. So this month we've received a postcard from Andrew Thomas, and it says, "Dear Jodcasters, I've enjoyed Haratina Mogosani's Southern Sky Notes and Maori traditional stories. Inspired, I visited Mount John Observatory on South Island for a view of a really dark southern sky. Inspiring. Keep up the good work on the Jodcast. Jod on. Andrew Thomas."
Ah, that's lovely.
So that's all the way from New Zealand.
That's really cool. I love it when we get posts. It's always exciting when we get some posts. And it's got a lovely picture on the front of it of a nice dark night sky. I'm guessing taken where Andrew Thomas is.
I would assume it's taken from the observatory on Mount John.
Yes, it's lovely.
Seems like it's very good picture.
Gorgeous. Great.
But this just because there's no email.
Oh, that's very sad. But we do have some Facebook. So we've got a message from Vasily Galkin, who says, Hey pals, as the October Extra episode has just gotten downloaded to my phone, I've realised that this November is 7 years since I started listening to the Jodcast. So I've decided to just share my little story with you. He says he's far from being an astronomer, but he's a physicist engineer by education. I mean, that's not that far.
Pretty close.
That's quite close. Working as a software engineer, and he has been listening to the Jodcast to help improve his English. So he says many things have changed in his life over the period in which he's been listening to the Jodcast. Got his bachelor and master's degrees at university, become a professional programmer, got acquainted to his wife, and he's hoping to become a happy father in the coming months. Oh, that's lovely.
Congratulations.
Oh, gorgeous, a little John baby. hoping to give you another update in another 9 years. So yeah, hopefully by then you'll be raising a young astronomer who listens to every single episode of the Jodcast. And it would be really fascinating to ever be able to see you guys in person. He signs off from a from Moscow, from snowy Moscow with love. So I don't know if we'll ever do a worldwide Jodcast tour, but
I'm
maybe
definitely up for that.
Yeah. It would be cool. And Moscow is lovely. Oh, he gives special greetings to Matt, Megan and James, so I'll make sure those get passed on. In the event that we don't manage to pull off our worldwide tour, in about 9 years' time, it'll probably be almost time for another live show, so maybe Vasily, you could come visit us in Manchester for the next live show. Okay.
From Facebook, we also have Ben Dyer. He says, from Campaign 11 on Kepler, amazing stuff. Campaign 11 began on September 24th, but was interrupted for 3 days. To make a small pointing correction to accommodate the imbalance that was created by broadcasting data from a different antenna on the other side of the spacecraft. Although the spacecraft is as big and heavy as an SUV, it actually turns slightly when we change the broadcasting antenna. This is like having your car begin to turn from the force of blinking your turn signal.
Oh, good God.
Yeah, the spacecraft is that delicately balanced.
Cool.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, thanks for that update, Ben. So on Twitter, I've got two tweets this month, and it's two photographs. The first photograph that we got on Twitter is from an old Jodcaster whom you may all be familiar with, Jen Gupta. She's one of the founding members, I think, of the Jodcaster. Certainly was there in the very early days. And Jen has sent us a picture of her wrist because she has a new tattoo on her wrist of the Jodcast logo.
Wow.
Jen, that's really cool.
That's commitment.
That is commitment. That's amazing. I feel like we should all get one. I feel like we should all have one, but I'm terrified of needles, so I can't do it.
Afraid of pain.
Yeah. that's a rational fear. So yeah, that's well done,
that's
Jen.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's very brave and very dedicated. So yeah, she's got a lovely, it's just a little black outline of the Jodcast star. It's very tasteful. It's very, very nice. So, jod on, Jen. That's amazing. And then We have a beautiful image from Philippe Cahill, the moon this morning in the climb from Heathrow. It's a lovely picture out the window of an airplane of a lovely morning moon. I really like that, actually. It came up on my Twitter feed a few days ago, and as a person who loves to take pictures out of the window of the planes myself. Because I often...
Right up your alley.
Yeah, no, I loved it. I thought, oh, that's a really nice shot. It's a gorgeous shot. So thank you for that, Philippe.
Now, if you want to get in touch, you can do so via the website at www.jodcast.net.
Or Twitter at twitter.com/jodcast. Or on Facebook at facebook.com/jodcast.
YouTube at youtube.com/jodcast.
Flickr at flickr.com/groups/jodcast. And don't forget that you can send us posts. The address is on the website. So, thank you to Professor Ray Norris for the interview. The editors were Naomi Asabre-Frimpong, Tom Armitage, Claire Bretherton, Ian Evans, and Xiaojin Liu. The producer was Monique Henson. Until next time,
Jod on!